Welcome to Seeking Alpha's Wall Street Breakfast, your daily source of market news and analysis. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher.
Welcome to Seeking Alpha, Alpha Talks, Editor's Roundtable, What Moved Markets This Week, the week ending Friday, April 9, 2021. A quiet week on Wall Street where not much of anything really happened. We had a speech by Fed Chairman Powell where he stuck to his script. We had a couple of data releases, the PPIs today perhaps being a notable one, but the market seems to have shrugged that off, seeing how the year-over-year comparison is so discombobulated due to COVID. We did have stocks make highs, new record highs, especially the S&P this week. And so that's where we are. We have a special guest this week I want to introduce, along with the usual panelists who I will identify now in no particular order. They are my Seeking Alpha colleagues, Brad Olison, VP of News, Kim Kahn, Senior News Editor, Stephen Alfer, Managing Editor of Breaking News, all of it moderated by me, Nathaniel E. Baker, Senior Editor of Strategic Contributors. And our special guest this week is Nick Colas, co-founder of Data Trek Research. And I want to start with him. And Nick, you had a piece this week that was titled, What Could Go Wrong? Five Ideas. The first one of these is interest rates, which is a bit of a wild card. The Fed's either going to act or they aren't. But you had some other ones here, and we're interested in having you maybe talk through one of them in particular, which is the geopolitical risk.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me. You know, the reason to talk about what could go wrong is because we're at new highs. That's when you want to begin to think about the playbook for what happens when the unexpected happens. And that's what we centered on with that piece for clients. The interest rate component is the most obvious one. I think we would all agree that that's going to be an issue in some way, in some form. But I think we have to put it against the backdrop of what is the U.S. consumer going to do over the balance of the year, because that is going to be the impetus for higher prices. We simply don't know the cadence of consumer spending recovery. We know there's a lot of dry powder, $1 trillion in money market funds, a lot of money in M2. All of that's going to get unleashed at some point. But the question is first, how fast? And second, where? And that's going to be the driver of inflation. That's going to be the driver of higher prices. And to some degree, the markets come down on the side of saying, the consumer recovery is going to be slow and steady versus a quick burst out of the gate, because that's why 10-year yields stopped going up. The market realized the consumer is not just going to go hop on 15 planes the back half of the year and take a bunch of vacations. It's going to be a slow and steady recovery, and that gives earnings visibility. So that's our response to that issue of what could go wrong, but it is the thing that could go wrong. And ironically, a faster recovery creates more inflation, higher rates, and lower valuations. So we're kind of... the market's saying it's the best of all possible worlds right now.
Now, there was some data released this week that you referenced in a different piece you put out by the Fed that showed that some of the stimulus checks was so far, at least this latest round, was more of it going to paying off debts and padding savings. Now, what happens if that trend continues to hold?
Yeah, that's a fascinating piece. The New York Fed does some really good work, and that was a great piece. They looked at stimulus 1, 2, and 3 and found that only 25 to 29% of stimulus dollars actually went into the economy right away. The vast majority was saved or used to pay down debt. And it's that dry powder that we have to think about when we think about future growth in the economy. No one really knows how this pace is going to evolve. We have the Roaring Twenties analogy, which people love to use, which I kind of dismiss because that is not a comparable period. For better or worse, war is horrible, but it's a period of full employment. World War I was that, COVID was not. So I kind of dismiss that. I wonder how much it's going to be like the Great Depression era people thinking they've got to keep savings because who knows when the next recession is going to hit. That's the balance we have to play. So that is the discussion. That's the central market discussion. Look at Home Depot making new highs. What does that tell you? It tells you people are spending money on their homes, which is fine. That's good. It helps the economy. But it's not that hypercharged, let's get back out and go out to dinner and go take trips and go spend on discretionary things that we did in 2019. It's a very different cadence of a recovery.
All right, very interesting. Let's bring the other panelists into this, maybe starting with Kim Kahn to give us the lay of the land and how this all works into the big picture of what moved markets this week.
Yeah, this week was, it's a low volume, quiet week. We've seen kind of tapes that we haven't seen in a while where you could see what's going on in the morning, and that kind of same action was there at the closing bell. So I think that, market focused a little more. We've got earnings coming up, so there's a little caution there. And also looking at macro views more. So we had Jamie Dimon out saying that, the economic boom in the U.S. could continue until 2023. On the other side of the coin, you've got Citi out saying that there's a bit of a 1999 vibe to the market action, with fund managers just chasing returns without any kind of concern for risks down the road. And then you've got the Fed speakers out. Richard Clarida was out today being super dovish, saying that they wouldn't even have enough actual data to make a decision until early next year. So, there's plenty of time. And then kind of on the other side of that, there's Robert Kaplan, who's saying that he'd like to remove some of the extraordinary accommodation measures as soon as the pandemic is over. But then there's no definition of when the pandemic is over.
Yeah, interesting. Although the 1999 comparisons are not exactly new, but it sounds like this is more of a bearish view because if memory serves, and I was alive in 1999, it was a very good year for risk assets, and especially stocks, especially tech stocks. But they're saying this is going to end now sooner rather than later. Was that the premise?
The premise is, that there's returns are being chased with no kind of consideration that things could end badly. And there's tax hikes out there. There's removal of accommodation. And I think that they were just kind of surprised. They had a trading range of 3,600 to 4,000 on the S&P, and now near 4,100. So I think that they're thinking that that's just a bit moved too far for them.
Yeah, we're getting there close. All right, how about winners and losers? As I mentioned at the outset, it was a pretty quiet week, low volumes, but there must have been some that did better than others. Brad, what's your take on that?
Sure. So those numbers kind of lead me to be the opposing force here. I know we have a lot of caution with the market at highs and Kim's bearish outlooks that he chose to cite, but the winners and losers to me pointed to overarching bullishness. One research report I noticed this week was that the technology industry group went from the least extended versus its 50-day moving average to its most extended just in the last five trading days. Technology was by far the biggest winner this week. One of the more notable winners was Twitter, up 11%. Obviously, that's very stock-specific. They went from trading down last week with Trump moving forward with his own platform to multiple reports about them getting into audio platforms, looking to monetize their Spaces platform, and also considering buying Clubhouse. The other big winners this week were reopening plays. You had some of the gambling names like Caesars and MGM, both up rather strongly. Morgan Stanley upgraded them on a Vegas recovery. Some of the cruise lines also were some of the biggest winners. You had Carnival Cruise got multiple upgrades this week. This followed an update on their bookings, and Norwegian Cruise Line as well, also one of the better performers, up 10% after releasing their recovery plan. And I take Nick's point. I mean, I know you can't get on six cruise ships at the same time, but it does seem like there are definitely some green shoots, at least that the market's pricing in. On the other hand, oil, after the crazy moves we've seen over the past couple of weeks, definitely took a breather this week, off 3% and 10% off of some of its March highs. And the bottom 10 performers in the S&P were almost entirely energy focused. With you had the Occidental Petroleum, Pioneer Development, and that they had a $6 billion deal that's pending, but Marathon Oil too and Diamondback Energy were also down more than 7%.
Interesting. All right, Stephen, what were you watching this week?
I'll just continue a theme from last week and pick up on what Nick, Kim, and Brad just said. A lot of speculative excesses have been washed out. The GameStop thing, the work from home stocks, the fact that Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook were going to go up forever and carry the market with it. Those have all been washed out, but the averages keep making, are once again at new records. The S&P and Dow are certainly at new records. The NASDAQ's within a few points of new records. So, To me, it feels more mid-90-ish rather than 1999-ish, kind of when yeah, there were these isolated speculative bubbles, but the average, and that kind of came and went, but the averages kept going. So I find that really interesting, and it, you know, kind of leads me to be somewhat bullish going forward for the rest of the year. And another story that interested me was Levi Strauss, which reported earning results this week. Their CEO Chip Berg was saying they're planning to open quite a few new retail outlets in the coming year, and it just kind of points to kind of the regenerative nature of things in this country, right? The cure for low prices is low prices. So he talked about a commercial property tsunami. So while obviously that's bad for shareholders and whatever Washington Prime Group or CBNL or certain retailers, it's good for other companies who are going to get some prime locations at really good prices. So really fascinating ongoing story to me.
Yeah. All right. So, let's go back to Nick here. And I touched it at the outset, these geopolitical risks. Give us an overview of that, because that is something that we haven't heard much about. Everything was focused on Corona, but you know, you still have issues in China, South China Sea, and a bunch of these other things going on now. So yeah, what's your thinking on that?
Yes, I mean, this was something interesting about COVID, and I don't want to ever say anything was good about it, but one of the less bad things about it was it really limited the ability for big geopolitical events, basically wars. It's impossible to put a million people in the field to fight a war if there's a pandemic going on, if they're not vaccinated. You don't have the military personnel, they're going to get infected, and you don't have the medical staff to support them either. So it created this kind of oddball 12-month peace dividend, because you just couldn't do that. As countries get inoculated, I assume that they will inoculate their militaries kind of very early on in the sequence, and we've got that peace dividend taken away from us. And now we have to go back to the old world, which is, yes, geopolitical conflict does occur, and it can be meaningful at times. You know, we've all been around the block in this business quite a few times. Remember Iraq and Kuwait in 1990, the two Gulf Wars, 9/11. No one wishes any of these things to happen, but as an investor, we have to think about what are the relative conditions. And we went from being basically having zero risk of geopolitical problems last year to some very meaningful ones, potentially in the next 3 to 5 years, and markets sniff that out. I tell you, it's the one reason I always tell clients, never be underweight energy, no matter how bad it looks, because it is one of the few sectors that works in a Middle East geopolitical problem. So never, never, ever be underweight energy.
Are there any particular spots, geographic hotspots, that you guys are more concerned about than others?
You know, China, I think, is top of everybody's list for I think most of the obvious reasons. The tensions started to rise during the Trump administration and have really, you know, President Biden seems to be continuing the vast majority of that trajectory. And so China was going to feel hemmed in, and, you know, they have economic problems as well. That to us is the biggest potential flashpoint, but we don't precondition the analysis on anything. We just kind of keep looking for where it might come, because as we all know, it does happen. Every 5 to 10 years, we get kind of a major geopolitical problem, and we're a little bit past due.
One place that's been quiet is North Korea. They tend to greet a new administration with some literal fireworks, and they haven't done that yet this time. So maybe that's, and every time the market freaks out a little bit, especially over in that part of the world. But, you know, luckily so far, it hasn't amounted to anything. Anyway,
yeah, totally, totally. And Taiwan as well. I mean, Taiwan's sure. Sort of the other latent issue. And Taiwan and South Korea are fantastic stock markets this year. So the market's saying no problems right now.
All right. Let's move on to the segment of the show where we discuss our favorite news articles or Seeking Alpha opinion pieces or other stuff that we may have seen or edited or perhaps even written. We just had our guest present his. Why don't we go to Kim Kahn and get his submission for the week?
I was looking at the deal that Netflix made with Sony Pictures as kind of a lay of the land for how reopening is going to be kind of a new normal. And I thought it was, you know, one thing it does is it brings Spider-Man back to Netflix and gives them a superhero kind of franchise after they lost DC to HBO Max, they lost Marvel to Disney Plus. But I think it's interesting. It comes the same week as a good performance of in the theaters for Godzilla versus King Kong, which was also out at the same time on HBO Max. And I think that Netflix is kind of angling to get one of these, simultaneous releases where, you know, it's got something, movies coming out in the theater and also, you know, streaming at the same time. And with Sony Pictures deals starting next year, they'll have that, you know, with tentpole films. Mm.
I have not been to the cinema in over a year. I don't know if any of you guys have.
No.
Everyone's shaking their head. All right. Yeah. So there you go. There's something potentially. Stephen, what about you? Favorite stories?
Yeah. And since we have Nick here, I'll say my favorite story is something Data Trek did. And it might have been the story you were referencing earlier. But Nick, towards the end of one of your items, you said, going forward, what would you rather own? Bitcoin or the S&P 500, Coinbase or JP Morgan, PayPal or big cap financial names, or a basket of SPACs versus the NASDAQ. And the commonality is obviously, would you rather own going forward the hot new thing or the old school thing? And for the life of me, I can't figure out where your sympathies lie. So I just wanted to ask you about that.
Well, then I've done a good job. Yeah, the point there was, you know, the vast majority of investors look at indices as the way they kind of create exposure to risk and create exposure to return, which is fine. But you can miss a lot with that. You know, there's no Bitcoin in the S&P, obviously. But PayPal is less than 1% of the S&P, been a fantastic stock, a clear winner. We've seen it in our business. PayPal is just taking share leaps and bounds. And yet the financials are 11%. So you can have the right idea, like, hey, yeah, things are going to be okay economically, but you can position incorrectly as a portfolio manager. You can position incorrectly as a retail investor and not be exposed to the things that really, really work. And that's the difference between a 5% return and a 20% return.
Hmm. All right.
Great stuff. Thanks.
All right. All right. I think we know where Stephen lies in that debate. No?
You have no idea.
Okay. All right. Maybe he just likes the news angle of that.
I like the news angle.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Fair enough. How about Brad?
So I'll steal some of Stephen's usual territory and tread into the crypto market myself a little bit with the CoinDesk filing. I mean, they're due to come public via direct listing next week, but they released their preliminary figures in a filing this week. And by all accounts, they were blowout figures. D.A. Davidson raised their price target on the exchange by about 3x. I think the price target now is $440. They're pricing an evaluation of 20 times 2021 revenue. And you know, I think by all accounts, you had 1.8 billion in revenue in Q1. Their adjusted EBITDA was 1.1 billion. So just a phenomenally, profitable enterprise, at least from what the filings are telling us. And there was just an interesting story that we wrote earlier this week on how Robinhood is kind of doubling down and trying to get into that space. And I think maybe they see the economic profit on the wall and they want to take a slice for themselves. But just a story to watch into next week, following some of those very healthy numbers that, and at least in the crypto market.
Yeah, next week is going to be a big week. We have earnings kickoff in earnest with the financials and that IPO, obviously. For me, my favorite story of the week was something, some of you guys have touched on this, but Jamie Dimon's letter, which is quite bullish and talks about this kind of perfect Goldilocks economy extending into 2023. And he's one of the few people I do pay pretty close attention to when he comes out with these things, because as the head of the biggest, I think it's the biggest lender in the US, you know, he would have a pretty good view into this thing. Sure, he's talking his book on some level, of course, but his statements so far have been pretty on point. And this was I thought that was pretty interesting and pretty bullish about the medium and long-term future of the economy and perhaps of markets as well. So that was what I had.
I did have a question for Nick based upon the fact that this note did come, it was born from the fact that we are at the highs, and we talked about how interest rates could hurt valuations and that could be a potential risk for stocks. We also have AAI sentiment near 60%, and the breadth, I think, in the market is also rather impressive. You have participation from all these various industry groups. It's no longer tech leading us to the upside like it was seemingly every single day last year. When does that begin to worry you? I think we've talked on this program quite a few times about how, you know, valuation in and of itself is not a catalyst for a sell-off, but when do you potentially see, or what are you looking for in a potential sentiment shift that could start to chip away at some of those foundational bullish signals?
Yeah, I tell you, I spent a couple of years working for Stevie Cohen back at the old SAC, and one of his favorite mantras was math is not an edge. If you presented a PE argument to him, he would not like it. So I totally embrace the idea that a PE ratio is essentially an interesting marker, but meaningless for stock picking or asset picking. The single thing I'm watching is Fed Funds futures. December Fed Funds futures, how much they discount the potential for rate increase. And I'm also looking at five-year treasuries because I take Powell at his word that we are going to get 2 years of zero rates. That doesn't help the market if we've got to go 50 bips three times in 2023. So I'm looking at how the market evaluates the inflation picture versus future Fed policy and to what degree the market thinks that inflation can squeeze the Fed into a rate increase. You know, Fed Fund futures has been fantastic at predicting rate increases, much better than human economists. And so I think we all have to take Powell at his word on policy. I think we have to take the idea that the market understands some inflation is coming. My bottom line is, no matter what, how many bear cases you want to lay out, you still have tremendous stimulus, more with infrastructure, zero rates, QE. And so the balancing act is always going to be, how much do you believe in fiscal and monetary policy, and how much do you believe in these risk factors? I believe in both, but I believe you have to be long here. The market still continues to go higher because there's so much confidence over incremental earnings, corporate profit leverage, and general economic conditions that it's very hard to get bearish until you think the Fed is forced into a policy change, or until you think the bond market says, forget it, they're behind the curve so much that 2023 is going to be 150 basis points. Until those things happen, you stay long. That's my point of view.
Very interesting. That's a very nice way to close the show. Although just on the Stevie Cohen point, I will add that the New York Mets are 2-2. Interesting game yesterday. Anyway, 5-1. What's that?
Phillies are 5-1.
Phillies are doing really well.
Yeah. Having just taken 2 or 3 from the Mets.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And beating DeGrom.
Yeah, well, no, they didn't beat DeGrom, the bullpen.
They got into the bullpen, that's right.
Yeah, DeGrom is hard to beat, but the bullpen a little less so. Anyway, on that note, we thank you all for watching and listening, as the case may be. Maybe, Nick, you could tell our listeners or viewers where they can find out more about you and your firm. I don't know if you're active on the social media. I imagine you have a website.
We do. Datatrekresearch.com. There's a box right up top. You can sign up for a 2-week free trial. No credit card, no personal information, just an email address. You can see what we do if it's right for you.
Very good. And if you've been listening to this and did not get a chance to view it, you can see the videos at the website seekingalpha.com/videos, also on the Seeking Alpha YouTube channel. With that, we thank you for watching or listening, as the case may be. Wish you a healthy and happy weekend, and look forward to speaking to you again next week.
That concludes today's Wall Street Breakfast. Thank you for listening. For the best investment analysis and news on the web, go to seekingalpha.com. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can sign up for our other podcasts, Behind the Idea, Essay for FAs, Let's Talk ETFs, the Cannabis Investing Podcast, and Marketplace Roundtable on those platforms as well. Have a great day.